Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, happy Friday. Hope you had the chance to check out the conference I appeared at yesterday, Freedom in Progress, put on by FreeUp. Quick reminder before we get into today's episode, it's Friday, so you could check out the podcast's Substack that will be going out. You can find the link to the show notes. Secondly, this show is supported by a Supercast. So if you'd like to support our work, help us really finish strong with this 2022, you can go to realignment.supercast.com. Lastly, as I mentioned during yesterday's announcement episode, we are doing an expanded Q&A episode with everyone's questions and comments and thoughts after the 2022 midterms that will come out this upcoming Wednesday. So definitely, if you are a Supercast subscriber, you know where to send those questions on the Supercast page. But if you are not a subscriber, since we're opening this up, you can just email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com or reply to the Substack that's coming out later today. On to today's episodes. As I mentioned last Friday with my conversation with Jonathan B. about René Girard's thought, I'm doing a couple episodes that are focused on philosophy and how philosophical ideas and how political philosophy and different sorts of ideas can approach problems we're having. So last week was about René Girard. This week is with a previous realignment guest, Lars Doucet. I appeared on his podcast at the start of September. It's called Narratives, that he hosts with Will Jarvis. Posted that in the feed. Go check it out. But today we're talking about an idea or a philosophy called Georgism. Lars has actually written a book called Land is a Big Deal, Why Rent is Too High, Wages Too Low, and What We Can Do About It. You know, we've spent a lot of time focusing on land, housing prices, wages, employment, all those good issues. And what he is putting forth here is this idea that Georgism is actually a way of solving for or answering a bunch of the questions we're going to have. So dive into this episode. It's a deeper dive, but like I said, it's Friday. Hope you all enjoy it, and we'll see you all next week. Lars Doucet, welcome back to The Realignment.
Howdy. How's everyone doing?
Howdy. As a new Texan, I'm going to start peppering in howdies. You're going to start seeing me roll into studios with cowboy boots in like April 2023. So thank you for slowly acculturating myself to this lifestyle, which is also useful because we're talking today about land, rent, housing, wages, all really relevant to Texas. So there's obviously something there. But folks will probably recognize your name because we did a cross-posting of a podcast I actually recorded with you in my house on the Narratives podcast. You want to go back, you asked me some really good questions that came out towards the end of August. So folks could definitely check back there. For today we're here to speak about your book, Land is a Big Deal, Why Rent is Too High, Wages Too Low, and What We Can Do About It. Let's do the first question here. You do a funny but also perceptive literary move at the start of the book's preface where you say, hey, I'm going to kind of write this as if a reader 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years from now were reading it. So you kind of describe the 2020s, what you kind of see about this moment, what's relevant. Diagnose the 2020s for me and then answer why is land a fundamental part of that story?
Right. So I think the 2020s are a unique, interesting story because what's interesting, why land is a big deal and why everyone's suddenly noticing it now of all times when the country is, how old is the country? 217, 76, 300, you know, somewhere in that range. I'm not doing the math immediately in my head, but it's because America has the mindset of a frontier nation that no longer has a frontier. And that is at the heart of what I believe to be all our contradictions and problems. Why the boomers say, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. I did it. Why can't you? And the answer is because of all the various frontiers that have been in American history, those frontiers are now closed for the current generation. And that has everything to do with America's history of land policies and why things worked really great for a while until they suddenly stopped working. And then just the rent started getting too damn high. And there are various periods where a frontier opens and then a frontier closes. And at the end of the 19th century was a period of kind of the end of the first frontier, which was westward expansion, railroads, taking land away from the Indians, you know. And the second frontier that opened was the invention of the automobile in the early 20th century. And that opened up a whole new category of land that was now valuable to people. But we've now reached the end of that as we've reached the maximum amount of suburbanization. And I can come back to this idea later. But that is what I think is the unique moment now, is that we've reached the end of kicking the solution to the land problem, kicking that can down the road and ignoring it, through just frontier expansion, because we've now run out of frontier. And now we're left in a situation much like Europe, where everybody owns the land, and now we just need to deal with that fact and all the consequences that come with it.
You know, this is helpful. Whenever we're talking about these YIMBY, yes in my backyard, no in my backyard debates about housing policy and land, pretty quickly, they kind of tend to descend into people on different sides of the issue kind of arguing about their ideal form of lifestyle, of living. There are people who hate cars, people who love cars, people who think that the suburbs are these 1990s era places that kill your existence. There are other people like me who say, wait a second, I pay less rent than I did in New York and I get a backyard. I love the suburbs. Where do you kind of come as someone who lives in College Station, Texas? Where do you come on the, like, what is the ideal Lars like housing mix?
Well, if we go by revealed preferences, you know, and pardon my voice, I've got a cough drop so that I'm not going to just be coughing every second. But if we go by revealed preferences, I live in the suburbs, right? You know, now that said, I don't love the suburbs. You know, I remember when we recorded your podcast at your house and I came and visited you, you mentioned that you had been suburb-pilled, that yes, you really enjoyed the suburbs. And there's a reason for that. The suburbs are very desirable for a reason. Who wouldn't want a maximum amount of land to yourself, you know, for your budget, with a nice home all to yourself, some separation from your neighbors, so you keep the noise down? Like, it's a very desirable kind of living situation. And the issue I have with the life in the suburbs is that, I mean, I've chosen it for a reason. I have narcolepsy, and one of my triggers is noise. And so I functionally can't live in cities. So if I did have a preference for a city, it's just kind of off the table because I'll have narcoleptic attacks every day, right? And so I live in the cities. I maintain my environment. I mean, I live in a suburb, right? But I have some problems with it. For instance, I don't like how car dependent I am. And I remember being a kid who grew up in the suburbs too. I had to ask my parents, I had to beg my parents to go anywhere to do anything, right? And that was really frustrating. And what's really interesting is that I'm a Norwegian citizen as well as an American. My mom's from Norway. I was born in Texas. And so recently I went to visit my family in Norway. And it's a small, nothing rural coastal town, not like some one of the hip cities like Bergen or Oslo or anything like that. We're just in this little nothing town. And my kids were just over the moon over the fact that there's just a little store that you can just walk to. They're like, you can do that? There can be a store that you can just walk to? And this was not like some super urbanist, like walkable city. That it was just literally a village with a store that you could walk to. And they just thought that was so cool. And the way I like to say it is that I'm not one of those necessarily like super F cars people, like Reddit/r/F cars, you know? It's like, I am kind of like, I wish we had smarter urban development. But what I really mourn is the loss of towns. We don't have towns and villages in the United States. We have suburbs, we have bedroom communities. And, you know, whether you want to have like the super urbanist hipster walkable community with a, you know, with a bistro and a bodega and all that stuff, like, I don't care about that stuff so much, but I would like to be able to walk to a store. I would like my kids to be able to walk to their friends' homes and their friends like live closer by them and not be dependent on a car for absolute everything. I would like to live in a village in a town rather than a suburb. Even though I prefer a suburb to a city, but I would much prefer a village or a town to a suburb. And we don't really have those in America anymore. So that is the ideal Lars living situation.
You know, I want you to spend some time on this idea of a closed frontier, because folks who are thinking about the frontier and your reference to the 19th century, you'll think of Frederick Jackson Turner, famous, you know, academic speech and then book comes out in, you know, the 1890s, because it's about in that period, the U.S. officially closed, right? The Homestead Act, it closed the period where you could move out west and just get more land. You're a, you know, European migrant. and you're living in New York or, you know, a kind of shack in Boston, you could just go west. That was the solution to the urban land problem then. But to your point, though, we're experiencing this lack of frontier now, but there's over 120 years between the closing of the frontier and at a literal level and the world of the 2020s. So can you just kind of talk us through, and we'll get into Georgism, which is the like idea we're kind of talking about here, but can you just kind of describe for me and the listeners those 120 years and where and what this idea of Georgism and how it fits into this?
Right. So Henry George, you know, his book, Progress and Poverty, I have it in front of me? What year was it published? I think it was published 1879. Yes, published in 1879. So that's about that period of the closing of the frontier. What exact year did you say?
1893, three, four, five.
Yeah, end of the 19th century, right? So Henry George was born in 1879. He runs for mayor of New York City in 1886. He actually beats Theodore Roosevelt for second place, but we'll get into him later. But the point is, he was writing at this time of the closing of the frontier. And so now we are back into another time period of the closing of the frontier. I mean, it closed decades ago, but in the modern age. But what happened in that 120 years? And this is the reason, this is the answer to the question of like, what happened to Georgism? Well, we'll get into it, is that we discovered a new frontier in the form of the automobile, right? And then we also had two world wars and the Cold War, which created, you know, this whole, the whole capitalist socialist dichotomy, which just sucked up all the oxygen for a century. But so what happened is we invented the automobile, and that opened a frontier. Now, not necessarily like when you think of a frontier, you think of like land that's available out there and you can just go there, right? So when we started industrializing, the value of land shifted from agricultural land to more urban residential land, right? Because productivity shifted from you raise crops to you make things in factories and stuff. And so basically the productivity moved from the field to your job. And so the real land value then is living somewhere where you can get a good job, right? Hang on, I'm going to cough. I'm going to mute. And so those land values go up as those as places get more productive, as cities get more productive. This is what the theory talks about. We can get into that in a later bit, is that the land values rise to match the productivity of the area. And the landlord basically captures the majority of that increase in production. And so it used to be, before the invention of the car, if you wanted to work in a very productive city, you had to live like really kind of really, really close by. Like you couldn't walk, you know, 120 miles. You know, and so that really limited where you could live in the proximity of the city. And so you got these really crowded like tenements, you know, all these people who wanted those jobs and were needed for those jobs, but were basically being priced out of the housing at that time. Like you had a housing crisis at that time that very much rhymes with the one today. I mean, it was worse in many ways. Like you just have this like horrible grinding poverty at the time. And another thing we forget is that America, like there was like open discussion of whether there would be a socialist revolution in America, right? Because things were so bad, people were like, well, is this the end of capitalism? You know, and socialism also hadn't like crystallized into being synonymous with Marxism yet. There were a bunch of other competing people like Proudhon and other academics and writers and theorists that were out there before Marx just basically became the canonical socialist. And then there were other competing theories like Henry George, who had this other idea about what was wrong and how to solve things. And he very much focused on the land issue. And so when we invented the automobile, it allowed you to commute into work, right? So now that opens a new frontier. There's all this land, like America has plenty of land. There's plenty of land in the Nevada desert today, but nobody cares because it's not productive land, right? And so what matters is productive land. So land 60, 120 miles out of the city center, you know, if you've got a car, you know, you can commute a certain amount of distance in before it becomes, you know, not worth it anymore. And the traffic gets too bad. But there's like this limit within, we can just expand outwards. So, I mean, we had two world wars, which kind of put everything on pause for a while. But after that, it's like, okay, let's build these highways. And those highways led to this building of suburbs. And we moved out of those suburbs. And certain people were excluded from access to suburbanization, you know, notably Black people in America and other minorities. But for those who were lucky enough to be in on that frontier expansion, you know, the kind of parallel there is like white settlers were the winners of Frontier 1.0, Indians were the losers. And you know, you kind of had a mirroring of that with Frontier 2.0. And I forget exactly the year it is. I had an interview with Noah Smith where he basically said exactly when home building peaked. I think he said 2006 or so. But that's like kind of Noah Smith's answer about when the frontier kind of closed. We reached the limits of that. And there is a Frontier 3.0, but it's very wimpy. And that Frontier 3.0 is work from home.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah. And so people are saying that, like, some people were hoping that, like, work from home would be the new frontier. If we ever invent perfect teleportation, like just Star Trek teleportation, that will be Frontier 4.0. But I don't think we'll invent that. But we're already seeing that, like, the work from home frontier closed very quickly because all the infrastructure was essentially already laid for it. You know, it might have a little bit more give to it, but basically, like, it took us the whole century, you know, with world wars thrown in there, to kind of expand out all that infrastructure and then have it be fully priced in. That's what really represents the closing of the frontier, is when the privileges and benefits of all that extra productive land is now priced into acquiring that land. And in work from home now, it's like every house in the suburbs that hasn't, you know, that you could build an extra bedroom on for, you know, a home office, or that, especially everywhere that has good internet, like, you're already paying a lot more to go there. And that amount is starting to approach the extra benefit you could get. It's an open question of exactly like how close that frontier is, but it's going to close a lot faster than the long march of suburbanization, because you got to build all these highways.
So, and the key thing here is what you're essentially saying is you got the Levittown. So post-World War II, like the first suburbs, there's 60 years of growth and opportunity and space here, regardless of how long the work from home revolution will go. Your point is the period is just much shorter by definition, which limits how transformative it's going to be. Is that a good way of summing up?
Yeah, basically it's like whatever opportunity is there basically gets eventually fully captured by the people who own the land. And the amount of time it takes for people to realize those productive gains and price it in with work from home, just in laying out that infrastructure, is much shorter period of time. And so us getting to the end of that phenomenon is much faster than with the automobile suburbanization.
This is where I want to double down a little more on what Georgism and who Henry George was, because it's kind of funny. I actually had a bunch of listeners send emails over the past year asking me to do an interview on Georgism. So your book actually was really conveniently timed. Shout out. I forget the folks' names, but I'm happy I was able to deliver for you eventually. But, you know, you keep talking about land. And as I'm thinking about this as a person who surveys the narrative, like as an interviewer, I don't really hear folks talking about land. We had Connor Doherty from the New York Times, who wrote a great book on housing on. And we talked about housing. We talked about regulation. We didn't actually talk about land. What is it about Georgism, having trouble with that word, Georgism, that places land so much at the center of things?
So the way I would say it is that, you know, you go into any economic debate and everyone talks about labor and capital, right? And what are those two things? They belong to a class of things called the factors of production. If you open any econ textbook, they'll talk about the factors of production. And the factors of production are things that come together to allow us to produce wealth, to do any useful work, right? And most econ textbooks and even most neoclassicals and Marxists will admit that there's not two factors of production, there's three. And those factors are land, labor, and capital, right? And then some econ textbooks will throw in like entrepreneurship as like a fourth factor of production, but that's kind of like fuzz, you know? But so when you think about the factors of production, you need these three things to do anything. You need labor to do anything. You need to like do some work in order to produce something. And then capital is kind of a force multiplier, right? George argues you technically don't need capital, but if you want to like get a lot of work done productively, you do need it. And capital means like wealth set to the purpose of getting more wealth. And then land, anything you need to do it in a location. I like to say you can't eat, sleep, work, or poop without access to a location. And if you do any of those things in a location that's unauthorized for you, bad things will happen to you. Like if you try to sleep on a park bench, you can get arrested, right? You know, and so, and if you think about it, you know, if you're a brilliant programmer and you live in India, you know, there's a certain difference in the amount of wages you can get than if you have if you are a US citizen and you're allowed to live and work in the United States and have access to that job market, right? And so land is a necessary factor of production. And the difference between other economic philosophies is other economic philosophies treat land as if it's basically a species of capital. And Henry George, basically, his insight was, no, it's not a species of capital. Capital behaves very differently from land. It needs to be treated as its own unique thing. And everything flows from there. The way I would like to describe it is it's kind of like trying to do chemistry without the periodic table, right? It's like before we had chemistry, we had alchemy, you know, and before we had astronomy, we had astrology. And there were very brilliant people working within those frameworks, but because they were missing this fundamental theoretical insight of what the building blocks even are, they were kind of limited in the solutions they could imagine. And George's contribution is it's like land is just as important as labor or capital. In fact, it's even more important. And if you understand how it's different and how it just affects the economy, then it changes your entire mind, changes the entire way you think about economics. Georgists have this kind of metaphor they call seeing the cat. It's like this little figure ground illusion, like a magic eye, where you're looking at it and you're like, what is that? It's just a landscape. But then you see there's this silhouette of a cat there. And once you see it, it's one of those illusions where you can't unsee it. And so that experience of understanding how land affects the entire economy, once you see it, you can't unsee it, is the way we like to say. And I can go into why that is in a second here, but I just want to end that thought and pass back to you.
No, you gave me my setup for my next question. Why?
Right. Why is land a big deal? And so that is the purpose of the book, you know, because it seems very strange. Here we are, both in our own homes, you know, teleconferencing virtually. You know, my background is originally in video games and stuff like that. So like these very virtual lives we live. What was sold to us is that land should matter less than it has ever mattered before. We are entirely virtual, ephemeral beings, you know, work from home, all this, like, and then someone comes along and says land is actually the most important thing in the economy, or at least more important than we're giving it credit for. Like, it just sounds so weird and backwards, right? And that is because I think a lot of people are over-indexing on the fact that agriculture is a smaller part of this economy than it has ever has been. And that's certainly true. But, and you can see this in some graphs that are in my book, I got them from Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century. He's done a lot of research and he's shown that most of the value that used to be in agricultural land has now just gone straight into residential land, right? It's almost a one-for-one transfer of the share of real assets. And so land is important. It's a different kind of land now than it used to be, but the same rule applies. And so in my book, I go out to like prove this, right? Land is a big deal. It's right there in the title. And I try to empirically demonstrate it in a couple of concrete ways. And the concrete testable hypotheses of is land a big deal are most of the value of urban real estate is land. So when you're buying a house in an urban area, like at least 70% of the value in most of your big coastal cities is just paying for the dirt, the location.
Quick take, you know, on this. You realize this on two levels. One, like I hope to buy a house next year. And if you Google on Zillow in Austin, there are lots of lots that are incredibly expensive. And you really realize that adding a house onto that wouldn't be that much more. Right. You also notice this. I started watching like Fixer Upper, you know, with Chip and Joanna Gaines just for fun to get myself in the home buying mode. And they're just like wreck the house. But the value is still there because it's just the land there. So I put what you just said through a new frame that I wouldn't have had like 6 months ago.
Right. With a lot of house flipping is actually just enabled. Like they're really, a lot of house flippers either think or they say that they're making value off of like improving the building. And that's possible, but that's mostly subsidized just by the fact that people are moving into the area and demand for the dirt is going up. So whatever they do to the house, they could totally wreck it, concrete the toilet. It's like, because someone will pay more for the land, even if they just plan on demoing whatever ugly shack they managed to rig up on it.
So yeah, what's the second part?
Okay, so the second way that land is a big deal is that America's land rents represent a sizable percentage of government spending. And this goes into Henry George's like idea that a land value tax could replace some or all other taxes. And a lot of people say that's not possible. I went out and I did the math and it shows out that it's like, we could pay for an enormous amount of our current spending just with a tax on American land rents.
How's it different than a property tax?
A property tax taxes buildings and land. And it actually punishes you for building. A land value tax taxes you only on the value of the land as if there was nothing on it, right? And the other three ways that land is a big deal is land represents a significant percent of all major bank loans, like a growing majority share. I think it's up to like 60% as of like 2010. So that's 12 years old. It's been going up in almost all countries. It's particularly bad in China, as you can imagine. But real bank loans are mostly just chasing real estate around. And we can see this with the effect that interest rates and stuff like that have on the price of real estate. And then land represents a significant percent of all gross personal assets. Real estate is the world's biggest asset class, like 67, it's two-thirds. Two-thirds of all real assets. And a real asset is like, take the paper wealth, decompose it into the atoms that it points to at the end of the day. Two-thirds of that is real estate. And then land is the key driver of that. So like if you take land and minerals and other things that are considered economic land, it's like 40% of real assets is just land. You know, it's easily a third of everything. And then land ownership is, of course, highly concentrated among the wealthy. So those are the ways that, and I have like figures empirically, like working all those out of all those different ways that land is a big deal. So it banks are chasing it, wealthy people are hoarding it, and the land rents produce an enormous amount of income, and most of the value of trying to buy a house in a high demand location is just paying for the dirt. That's how land is a big deal.
Okay, so here's what you've convinced me of. I did not think of land before I heard of Georgism or encountered your book, but you've got a subtitle, Why Rent is Too High, Wages Too Low. What does everything you just articulated have to do with rent and then the wages specifically?
Okay, so this has to do with, there's a guy called David Ricardo who comes from before Henry George. He's one of these English economists. If you've studied economics, you see him listed right alongside Adam Smith. And Adam Smith was a proto-Georgist, by the way. Henry George built off of a lot of the same recommendations that Adam Smith, Captain Capitalism himself, made. And David Ricardo has this thing called Ricardo's Law of Rent. And George uses this a lot to explain the mechanisms for how rent affects wages. And the basic idea is, I have this graph in my book here where I show that if you imagine that basically it means that the productivity of land gets soaked into the rent. So if you can earn more money at a location because it has access to a good job or if it's a good fertile agricultural field, your landlord is going to charge you more as that area becomes more productive. And the example is if you have two fields, right, and both of them could give you 100 units of wealth for working on it. But one of them is privately owned and one of them is just, it's common land. Anyone can go work on it. Why would you ever pay this guy any rent? You're just going to go work on the common land, right? And you're going to earn 100 units of wealth. And then there's a third field that only will give you 10 units of wealth. You're not going to work on the crappy field. You're going to work on the good one. You're going to earn 100 units of wealth. But now the landowner buys that second field and now you have to negotiate with him. Your best alternative is the crappy field for 10. So now he can charge you 89 units in rent. Because it's like, hey, you're going to make 11. Your best alternative is to go work for 10, right? And if he buys that third field, he can charge 99, right? You know, the absolute minimum, maximum amount he can charge, reducing you to subsistence. And so this is what we see is happening in big cities, is that as the city gets more productive, as more companies move in, you know, higher paying jobs, like in San Francisco, a family of four earning $100,000 is below the poverty line. That's insane. Like, how can you be making six figures and be below the poverty line? It's because you're paying it all in rent. Because the landowners know that this area is more productive. And so they can charge just right up to that limit. And as it gets more productive, we talk about all the things that increase productivity. This is why you can't technology and innovate your way out of this problem, because it will just increase the land values of the area even more and more and more. And so it might take a little while. There might be a little give before the land values catch up, but they always catch up eventually.
Here's what I'm really wondering here. I didn't put two and two together when you referenced Henry George outperforming Theodore Roosevelt when he ran for mayor of New York City. This is before he becomes police commissioner, undersecretary of the Navy, all that good stuff. Theodore Roosevelt, shout out. But I realized that, you know, Henry George plays a huge role in that portion of the story. This is in The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt by Edmund Morris. And I don't know if you've read the book, but Edmund Morris kind of portrays Henry George as a crank. So I'd like to hear you in good faith articulate why would a writer in the 1970s look back at how people thought about Henry George in the 1880s and think that this guy is a crank and there's something off about his thought. Like what give me that context.
Right. Oh, there's just a beautiful, I can do you one better even. There's a beautiful political cartoon in, I know that these are often audio only and I just
prefer an audiobook. We'll put it on the screen if you can send me the link too.
Yeah. But basically, there's this great political cartoon, and I'm practicing my audiobook in describing figures purely through audio. Here is a figure, and here we see a workman, and the devil is hovering over his shoulder, and the devil's labeled anarchy. And the devil is like conjuring this image of like Henry George in like white robes holding a cornucopia for the workman, and out of it comes like free lunch, no boss, you know, no taxes, you know, and it talks about how Henry George is basically this tempter of labor who's filling them their ideas with nonsense, right? And all he has is theories is the other thing. That was what everyone was saying, is like Henry George has nothing but theories, right? And so there's a couple of reasons why people like dismissed Henry George as a crank at the time. One is because he was on the side of labor, of the working person, right? And you always got to suspect people like that. Two, because at the time, America still has the frontier mindset now in 2022, when the first and the second frontiers have closed. So you can imagine in 1890, like the frontier hadn't been, you know, the frontier up until that point was just closing, like in 1886. It hadn't even formally closed yet. It's like that idea had not worn off. Like, hey, I made my money, honestly. I never needed a handout. Why do you need a handout? Why do you need to change the rules, right? And then also we have just the English system of land ownership, of what's called fee simple land ownership, where basically you pay some money for some land and then you just own it forever and you can sell it to anyone, whatever. That's very entrenched in the American system. And it just seems really intuitive to people that it's like, well, I paid for this land. That was the system that was set up. And you're suggesting any change at all to that. That's very threatening to me. It feels very unfair. You know, why should I, you know, why should I not have access to this land just free and clear? And like, why should I have to share it with anybody, right? That seems offensive to my sense of property rights.
Wait, so is that what Georgism was and is proposing? Like what actually is being proposed here then?
So George, unlike the other socialists, was not proposing that land should be like communally owned, right? So George could only really be, I wouldn't consider George a socialist. Like 19th century socialism is a very different thing than post-Marxist socialism, right? Yeah. Where socialism just means Marxism. But he was certainly like a laborist, let's say. And George, he did not recommend that we confiscate land or that we own it communally or make everyone live on a big hippie commune. And certainly not that we do any central planning. He was very against that. In fact, he didn't even have any problems with capital. He's just like, we need to just find out how to share the land. And I think the best way to do it is with a land value tax. That if we just capture the rents of just the land, not the buildings, but just the rents on the land, and we capture that, and we share that back with the community, that fixes the problem. It incentivizes people to stop speculating on land that they don't intend to use and just intend to use as an investment vehicle. And then those land rents that we capture can help make land affordable for anyone else. And by driving out the speculators, that drives down the price a little. And so he actually was an early proponent of what we would now call the universal basic income. It was called a citizen's dividend in his day. I'm not sure if he was he wasn't the first one to propose a citizen's dividend. It was kind of just in the air at the time. But he certainly was like, and you could use land value tax to fund a citizen's dividend or funding the government or whatever you want. And so that was his mechanism for how we share the land, is you can still own the land, because he thought it was still very important that you be able to own land and control what to do with it and make independent free market decisions about what to build there, rather than say have the government own all the land and the government centrally plans it and has all of those kind of failure modes. And he says, and then we should reduce taxes on everything else, because taxes on everything else are a drain on production. This was a time when America had lots of tariffs and things. So he was like, taxes on labor, like income taxes, are, you know, the wealthy can avoid those. And it's basically just a tax on work, so we get less work. And taxes on capital, we get less capital. That's very inefficient. So, but land, nobody produces the land. So they say, if you want to tax something, if you want less of something, tax it. Well, you can't make or destroy land, generally speaking. So if we tax land, we won't get any less of it. It's the only thing that pretty much behaves that way. So this is not only an efficient tax, it's also a fair way to get around the inequities that private land ownership causes. And then it gives us this store of value in recurring land rents that we then share with the community. And then that gives everyone a leg up to restore us to the condition of what we would have if we had an infinite frontier, which we don't. If we had an infinite frontier and we could just generate infinite earths, then we could have fee simple land ownership. But because we don't, and the frontier is closed, we need to find a way to share it, or it's going to come to a head and we're going to have this huge conflict.
So here's what I'd love to hear about. I'm curious about how you first came around to just discovering Georgist thought, but also just how you went from discovery to just evangelism. Like you said, you're a video game designer. On paper, you shouldn't be messing around with 1870s, 1880s political economic figures. What's that side of the story here?
Well, it's kind of funny. So Georgism had been something I encountered just as a background idea. You know, I'm an Eastern Orthodox Christian, and my priest was very into distributism, which is kind of this like Catholic philosophy. So I'm not Catholic, but we're like Catholic adjacent. And so like it was like kind of like this is a G.K. Chesterton was a distributist, for instance. And in distributist philosophy, they're very fond of Georgism. And so I was aware that it existed at all. So that's in the back of my mind. And then I'm working in video games and I discover recurring housing crises in the metaverse, in multiplayer, massively multiplayer online games. Virtual worlds have been consistently recreating housing crises, not just once, not just twice, multiple times over the past 30 years. And most recently with all of the crypto virtual real estate games, like, and that was actually my career at the time for the last year, is that video games is a really, really difficult career. And so lately my day job has transitioned into just being a consultant. And when the crypto bubble like got big, everyone wanted like people to tell them and advise them. And so I got hired by this firm called Novik to basically write high-priced newsletters for like a subscriber base of like investors and stuff. And I noticed all these virtual real estate games. It's like, hey, I noticed that there were housing crises in EVE Online and Final Fantasy 14 and Ultima Online, which is still ongoing. And now Decentraland and Axie Infinity and Bored Ape Yacht Club, The Other Side, and The Sandbox, all of these games are going in on this land model, and they're all going to have housing crises. And they did. And I was able to like measure it and like look at it. And I was just like, my Lord, we're like all of Henry George's theories are coming to life before our eyes in the metaverse, so to speak.
Quick question. Can you define a video game housing crisis? I think we have a very visceral image of a real life housing crisis. Like we're both in the middle of it. We remember 2008, obviously. What does it mean in Decentraland or EVE Online? Because it's infinite. Like to your point, it's kind of funny. You're saying if we could have infinite Earths, we wouldn't have this problem. By definition, virtual land should be infinite.
Yes.
So what happens?
So in the virtual world, scarce land is a choice. So the virtual world is different from the real world in two important ways. You can opt out of existing in any virtual world, right? You can't opt out of being in real life. Well, you can, but we strongly discourage that, you know, and we have hotlines to help people who are struggling with that sort of decision. But in the virtual world, like you can't opt out, you can opt out of virtual world. So you don't, strictly speaking, need land like you do in real life. But if you've decided to be in that virtual world, you know, that operates. The second one is that they could create more land if they want to. But what's interesting is that we have, in a sense, infinite land in America and Earth. I mean, it's not really infinite, but like we have not run out of land in Nevada, right? If you want to go live in a desert in Nevada, you can do that basically for free. But what really matters is land, basically land values soak up the value of communities, of other people, right? And so Ultima Online is a great example. They have shards, right? Different parallel complete servers of the world, right? Like exact, like here's Ultima Online Earth 1, here's Ultima Online Earth 2. But all the cool kids are on this server, so I want to live there. So Britain, that's the big city in Ultima Online, is more valuable in the server where all the people are, right? Because that's where I want to be. That's where all the economic activity is. That's called an agglomeration effect. So not only is that server more valuable, but the land around Britain specifically is more valuable, right? And so what it looks like a virtual housing crisis is, I'll give you an example. When I was 19 and playing like Ultima Online, you could, the way you would build a house is you'd like pay for a, you'd craft a scroll for a house and then you would place it somewhere on the map. And I could buy the house. I could buy like the thing that's like, okay, you can construct a house, but I couldn't find anywhere to put it because anywhere you could put a player built house, there was already a house there. And sometimes it would be like a really cheap, crappy one just to like take the space, right? You know, so you had virtual land speculation. In EVE Online, they had, it was more focused on production. And this was specifically in the very, very early days of the game. So I don't know how the current game is doing. It's been like decades. So in the early version, there were these nodes you can control on certain points of the map that would give you the privilege of producing spaceships, right? And so they had a full-on industrial recession of spaceship production. Like they launched the game and nobody's producing spaceships. So nobody, like the price of spaceships just inflates massively because they're so scarce. And it turns out squatters are sitting on the nodes that allow you to build spaceships. They're, and so what I realized was there's this class of asset that I call a land-like asset. And in video games, I say that because in a video game, you can call your asset anything. Okay. And so your metaphor might be like frogs or whatever. But if they're immovable and whatever, they could function like land. And so a land-like asset has three properties. It's scarce in supply, so you can't make more of it, or the developers have chosen not to make more of it. And more importantly, you have the expectation that there won't be more of it. Two, it's necessary for production. So some features of the game are going to be gatekept by this asset. And then third, it obtains value from its location, right? And this can exist on a sliding scale. So I give an example of like a permit, much like a taxi medallion in real life, only has two of those. It's scarce and it's necessary for production. So if you want to brew potions in Cliche Quest 12, Twilight of Subtitles, which I've just made up, you need to belong to the Witch's Guild. So I, as a, say, a master witch, I have a potion brewing permit. You're an apprentice witch. You can't make a potion, but you can use my license. I'll let you use my permit. And you basically pay rent to me for that. Now, those permits are fungible. It doesn't matter where they are. So if you add location values to it too, then you get a land-like asset. Now, a permit is still a speculative asset, but land is an even better speculative asset because locational values allow you to profit from your neighbors without doing anything. Because if I've got a hot dog stand in Times Square, I'm going to sell a lot of hot dogs. So if I can own land in, you know, Times Square somehow, that's going to be very, very productive for me, regardless of what I do with it. And it's the city of New York that's providing all that value. If I put the same hot dog stand in Nevada in the middle of the desert, I'm going to sell zero hot dogs, right? And the problem is, like, New York City could benefit from something more valuable than me taking up valuable space for a hot dog stand. You know, I mean, sidewalks notwithstanding, but like, you know, parking lots in city centers is a really good example of this. Like, our cities could do much better than that. But anyway, what's really funny about what do virtual housing crises look like? Decentraland's housing crisis is eerily similar to Left Behind American cities. Like, it's weird because it's a virtual world. So this is one of the crypto video games. And the idea with this is that you could like buy land. It's kind of like a dinky version of Second Life where like you can buy land and like build whatever you want and it's going to be like great. But what you actually have is that a lot of people just bought the land to just sit on it. And you have all these like decayed projects everywhere. And so nothing like physically decays, but like scripts don't work. There's little signs that are like, oh, that button doesn't work. So I clicked it, just walk through the door. It you know, I couldn't be bothered. And like you come into like a little amusement park and like it's like none of the rides work. And then there's nobody there except in one place. They're all playing poker in this like one central like little poker hall. And that's the only place anybody is. And so it's like it kind of feels like going through one of these like Left Behind American towns where they're just kind of decayed and run down. And the only people you really see out and about are all in like some slot machine parlor or liquor store. And it's just kind of depressing and scary. And so it was really kind of haunting to me that Decentraland, like usually like the parallels are kind of academic and abstract, but in Decentraland, it really hit me viscerally that it's like, wow, everything's decayed. It's a ghost town. And the only people left are like gambling addicts. That's scary.
So two last big questions. So number one, because I know folks are going to be thinking about this. I've had Matthew Ball on to talk about metaverses and virtual reality and land. What are just your broad thoughts on these digital spaces right now? Just totally aside from the land perspective, like as a video game designer, as someone who thinks about this at an academic level, like what do you think about it? Are you excited? Yay, nay? Like, yeah, what's here?
Yeah. Well, first of all the actually successful metaverses are not the ones a lot of people focus on, right? They think of like Facebook's Horizon, and they think of, you know, they focus a lot on the VR ones, but the actually successful metaverses are the ones that are just really accessible, that you can play on like a flat screen. And like, what's really funny is that what was the seminal book that gave us the word metaverse, like Snow Crash? I think in that, like a bunch of poor people accessed the OG metaverse just through like a regular computer with a flat screen, and only like rich people would go in like the fully immersive mode. And so games like Rec Room and VR Chat, which ironically, despite the name, you can just access from a regular computer.
Yeah.
And then what's the other big one? Oh yeah, just Roblox and Minecraft and Fortnite are kind of, those five are like the really big, actually successful metaverses where people go virtual third places, and they have tons of users. And additionally, Second Life is still around. It's got kind of a, you know, puts on sunglasses Second Life that it's experiencing because it has like, I compare like the daily active users of like these crypto video games to Second Life, and Second Life has like a really respectable amount, and it's kind of like been brought not back from the dead, but back from being ignored. And so I think if you really want to do a deep dive into metaverses that actually work, there's this guy called Raf Koster. He is the original designer of Ultima Online, and he has done Star Wars Galaxies and a bunch of. He's got this great series called, I think it's called How Virtual Worlds Work, and I'll send you a link to it. And it is like the best no BS treatment of what metaverses will actually look like and how they actually work, because he has 35, 40 years of experience of seeing this play out. So he's not making the same mistakes all the crypto people who came from finance and have no game dev experience just like made immediately. He's like, yeah, we made all those mistakes back in 1990. So we don't have to make them again.
So second to last question, then. You've contextualized things. I think you've described a status quo that a person who's curious about this space could embrace. But what would you say in 2022 in Austin? Let's say, right, peak of the COVID era housing problem for the foreseeable future. But what is the Georgist agenda? Like, what would you say a city council person should do? Because what's interesting about the housing debate, the way we typically talk about it, it comes down to YIMBY positions. We should make it so that you could develop anything on land. We should make it so that you don't have restrictive zoning. A NIMBY would say, oh, well, we can accomplish this by requiring more affordable housing with an existing thing. You don't have to change the underlying structure. I think you could easily understand the YIMBY NIMBY position. I don't quite understand as much what a Georgist influenced candidate would say. Yeah. A city like Austin with a suburban dynamic or a urban place like San Francisco. What's the agenda there?
Well, property tax reform is the agenda. Right. And I've practiced my pitch a lot on how you would sell this to conservatives in Texas, because that's my family background and the people that surround me, even if, you know, my political valence is Georgist, which is nicely and conveniently not on the traditional political spectrum. So it would be property tax reform. Move to a system where we tax land and we don't tax buildings and we reduce other taxes. And what this achieves basically is it destroys the incentive to hold land out of use. Like, I've seen people hold on to like acres of land next to major city centers and like College Station or whatever, and like they buy it for like six figures, sell it for 7-10 years later, and in that time period the community has been deprived of the benefit of that land. Like, we could have built housing on that, and because we didn't build housing on that, everyone else's house prices went up, right? You know, Houston is just filled with downtown parking lots, you know, and it just sprawls out for miles, right? And it doesn't need to. Like, so Houston lacks zoning. And so what's so funny is that Houston has flipped in my lifetime from being this like thing everyone made fun of to kind of like this like model example of, you know, we've done a much better job in Houston. Houston's probably the YIMBYest city in America, where you can just build because there's no zoning. There are like covenants on leases and stuff like that, but that's not nearly as strong as zoning. And like Houston has done such a good, like, we've reduced homelessness by a lot in the past couple of years because we just build homes. At the same time, we've sprawled out, and that's very environmentally damaging, and it's got all the problems of that. Texas, Austin, Houston, all of that is kind of difficult to do Georgism in because there is a state constitutional provision that comes from the 1910s, basically, that forbids us from doing Georgism. It's kind of this legacy of the Georgist fight. J.J. Pastoriza, Houston's first Hispanic mayor in 1911, passed basically a single tax policy in Houston. And he got shut down within 2 years by the Texas Supreme Court on the basis that it's like, you can't do property tax that way because reasons. And so we would need to repeal that with a ballot measure. But if we could do that, and then also Texas is a real estate non-disclosure state, which means that the property tax assessors are not allowed to have access to data from the realtors of like you're not required to send the property tax assessor the make how much you paid for the house legible to them. But we've overcome this recently because the realtors kind of like try to maintain a monopoly on access to MLS. Realtors, it's weird. It's schizophrenic. Like in some municipalities, they're great friends with the property tax assessor. In other municipalities, they're bitter enemies. I wish they could be friends.
Sure.
But in Texas, they're not friends. And but it doesn't matter because TransUnion has access to that data from the banks. And so in the past 2 years, every property tax assessor office in Texas now has access to real estate transaction data so that they could do the proper assessments to do something like a land value tax if they wanted, but for this state constitution provision that prevents it. And so that makes someone like me, I mostly have to operate in other states and just hope that we'll eventually build up awareness in Texas to get this, get a ballot proposition on, because it prevents any municipality that wants to experiment with split rate property tax or land value tax from doing so. But in Philadelphia and Detroit, so I'm actually moving long-term, you know, I'm going to be moving from the world of video games to the world of property tax assessment, actually. And I'm actually part of a research group that's modeling like Philadelphia and Detroit. And Detroit right now is very interested in a split rate property tax. A split rate property tax, this is how you do Georgism by steps. Split rate property tax is tax building separately at a separate rate from land. And obviously the end goal of that is to make the tax on building zero and the tax on land 100%, you know, and just collect the same amount of tax you're doing now. So the same like millage rates or whatever, like the same amount of tax budget, but from land, not buildings. That's very short of the whole maximum land rent collection, but it shifts the burden to land. And it has a lot of good equity features that happen. It pushes land tax towards the city center, towards commercial real estate, actually off of suburban homes. Also, landlords are underassessed relative to suburban homeowners, believe it or not, in a lot of places. And city center land is underassessed relative to residential land. And so a lot of us are subsidizing people who own the most valuable land. And so that is the policy I would follow, is first start by fixing the assessments. And I have a lot of initiatives with smart people I'm working on with that. And then move towards split rate property taxes. And we can do that in certain areas basically immediately. Detroit is basically just waiting on a good land study to be able to do it. And Philadelphia could move toward it. There's various places in Pennsylvania that could. Texas is forbidden because like at the state level, but if we could get a ballot initiative to get rid of that, then we could start experimenting with it in Texas. When you're operating under those state level provisions, even just fixing the assessments will get you closer towards it, because our assessments right now are based on what I consider some fairly outdated methods. And if we move to assessing land more accurately, you'll basically get kind of a partial land value tax and the partial effects of that. That's an advantage of Georgism that I feel like it has over philosophies like Marxism. You don't need a revolution to get started. Partial implementation gives you partial results. And then if you see those and they're good, then you go for a little more partial. And then you go for a little more partial. And I'm hoping that we can get some wins in some other states that are currently friendly towards it, or even other countries, and then do case studies there, and then study those case studies and use those to advocate it in other places. That's another value of assessments, is that you have to do the math ahead of time to be able to even advocate for this policy, because people will come at you with like crazy objections, like you're going to bankrupt farmers. And you're like, actually, there's an exponential growth towards the city center, so your farmland is really not worth a lot. You're probably going to get a tax break, Mr. Farmer, you know, but if you haven't done the math, like you can't quiet that what seems like a reasonable instinctive fear, because they hear land tax or like, Is that per acre? It's like, no, it's per value per square foot. And your land just isn't that valuable. So that is kind of in a nugget. I know that's firing off a lot, but like, how do you actually practically get there? That is kind of my policy proposal. And it's frustrating that in Texas, it's kind of out of my control at the moment, but I would love to see it done here in Texas. I like to say, bring back the Houston plan, bring back the Pastoriza plan.
So the last question that kind of comes from what you just said about the farmer and the agricultural land. Any change from the status quo is going to have winners and losers. Could you articulate who the winners are, who the losers are? I rent right now, want to buy a house. Would a more Georgist Austin at an individual level be a win or a loss for me?
It would be a win for you, because one thing we found about land value tax, and this is studied empirically, it's a major section of my book, is that land value tax, not just theoretically, but empirically, can't be passed on to tenants. And it's the only tax that can't be passed on to a consumer that way. And it has to do with the fact that land is inelastic in supply, that you can't make more or less land. And so renters would benefit.
Could you pretend, actually, not even pretend this is true. I didn't even make it through high school econ. Explain this to me.
Yeah. So
it's the Michael Scott joke. We're 10 number six.
No problem. So let's say I tax oil or cigarettes, like things like that, right? Why does the price go up for the consumer? How does it get passed on to the consumer? The way it actually, like, price is a function of supply and demand. So if the price is going to go up after a tax, for that to actually go all the way down to the consumer, it means that the demand has stayed the same, but the supply has gone down, right? And so why is that? Well, when you tax oil or cigarettes, there's a marginal tobacco farm or a marginal oil well somewhere that was making like 1 cent per unit of profit. And so if there's a 1 cent per unit tax, it's like, we're breaking even or losing money, shut down. Not all of it shuts down, because there's more productive wells and more productive farms than that, but the marginal ones shut down.
Sure.
And then that decreases the supply, demand is fixed, and the price increase per unit goes up by an amount almost exactly equal to the tax. That's how, you know, because people will always try to pass taxes on. Like, they don't do it out of the goodness of their hearts, but they're not able to because the market won't let them. Like, people will accept that because the supply has been decreased. But with land, because the landlord has to pay the tax whether they're renting a unit or not, and they can't increase or decrease the amount of land. And so land tax is one of those things that can't be passed on to tenants. But even if you don't buy the theory, there's just a bunch of empirical studies that show that it just doesn't happen. That when you levy a land tax, that tax is fully capitalized into the price, which means that because it's land income that drives land selling price rather than the other way around. So, like, here's a rock I'm holding. If this is a plot of land and I can make, I don't know, 10 units of money a year on it, right? I have some... The buying price of it is the net present value. Like, I have some discount rate over 10 years. Like, if I want to make my money back in 10 years, I'll pay 10 times what I can make in a year by holding this for it, and then hope to hold it for 11 years, right? And so if it's suddenly producing half as much, I'm going to pay half of what I was willing to pay before because it's producing half as much. And that's, so renters will win. So get back to your actual question, who wins, who loses? Well, anyone who is basically making land their investment vehicle exclusively loses. But this doesn't mean that every landlord necessarily is just completely hosed. There'll still be landlords in the Georgist utopia, right? They will just be property lords, building lords instead of landlords, you know? So, like, people say, well, my landlord maintains the property. They, you know, they helped me when the AC went out last summer. It's like, that's labor. That's capital. Yeah. You know, they'll still be allowed to get a return on that. But they won't get a return on, say, a slumlord who just holds a property and does the absolute minimum it takes not to go to jail. That person's going to be like, well, this isn't a productive asset. I'm going to sell it. And the only person who's going to buy it is someone's like, well, I'm going to build a lot of units here. I'm going to keep these maintained, you know, because otherwise it's not worth it because of the tax. And so, and it'll have a beneficial productive stimulus effect on building, which creates more units, which means there's more housing for people, which means that, you know, we'll be able to address the housing crisis. And if you want to live in the suburbs, if you want more nature, it's going to drive that density in. So this is not a everyone has to live in the pod situation. It's like if we were to convert some of these downtown parking lots into like big multi-unit things that should be there, that means you're not going to have to sprawl so far out. So if you want your nice house in the suburbs are not going to be so far away from the city anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like there shouldn't be single family homes smack dab downtown. That's an incredibly wasteful use of land. And because we have both restrictive zoning and a lack of a land value tax, everyone else is basically subsidizing that person for excluding everyone else from that land. We're basically all paying for that. And they should be paying everybody else. That's the reverse effect. But who wins, who loses? Anyone who's using land very unproductively is going to lose. It depends on how high the land value tax is and how extreme you want
better.
To go. If you just do a revenue neutral property tax shift to land, pretty much everybody but the worst actors comes out ahead. And so that's your politically viable like strategy. Like I did the calculations, you know, and like for my own home, and I'd like make plus $5 on my property taxes, you know. But the people downtown who have very unproductive land, they're going to get soaked. Those downtown parking lots are going to get soaked. If you move more towards George's ideal of 100% land value tax, that would like transform our society, would be net good for us in the long run. But there would be like, you know, holders of not perfectly used land, but like poorly used land who would be forced to sell. And there would be some gripes and some transition and a lot of political horse trading, probably just make it so it's like you don't have to pay the tax right now. Just when you die, we can attach it as a lien to the house or whatever. We can defer the payment, you know, for like the whole like, I'm a widow, I don't have an income situation. There's a lot of papering over of that, but that's maximum Georgism. That's not on the table. And so just the revenue neutral property tax shift to land, I think would be very palatable today and have a smaller number of constituents who lose than the rest of it. That's my take on it, at least.
I think that's a helpful place to leave it. The book is Land is a Big Deal, Why Rent is Too High, Wages Too Low, and What We Can Do About It. Lars, this has been really great. Thank you for coming back on The Realignment.
I appreciate it, Marshall. Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the show of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.